Hi and welcome to the 25 Minuter podcast, hosted by myself, Ludvig Sundström, and Mikael Syding. In today's episode, we talk to Fabrice Grinda, one of the world's best angel investors and current founding partner of FJ Labs, which has invested in more than 1,000 startups. Fabrice has a deep expertise in marketplace companies, having founded and sold three of these companies and been involved in many, many more. When he was 23, he founded Auckland, an online auction site, which became one of the biggest in Europe. Then he founded Zingy, a mobile content company with over 200 million in annual revenue. And then he founded OLX, one of the biggest websites for classified ads in the world, with over 300 million unique visitors a month. Some of the topics that we cover in today's conversations include what his portfolio looks like, a ton of book recommendations, Fabrice's advice for investing in private companies, and which industries and world problems he thinks will be most interesting over the coming years. Why he thinks the macro situation looks overall bad going into 2023, and why he thinks some of this decade's best investments will be made over the next 2 years, especially angel investments. And we also cover a lot more. I recommend you check out his blog at fabricegrinda.com. You can also find three great posts from his blog linked in this episode's description, and also a number of books mentioned. Having said that, let's jump straight into the interview. So Fabrice, you're a pretty interesting person for many different reasons, but I think partly because, first of all, you're an extreme specialist, first in creating online marketplaces and now in investing as an angel investor and many other things. But you're also something of a polymath with a broad range of interests and talents, coming up with and managing many different kinds of projects. So what I'm wondering is this something, this broad range of different projects, is it something that happened after you first gained your first specialization with online marketplaces? Or is it something that's been like a consistent theme for you all your life?
Well, thank you for the kind words. It's definitely, so to answer your question, I've kind of always been a bit of a polymath. I was always driven by intellectual curiosity. As a kid, reading on every topic possible and imaginable, from history to the sciences, to mathematics, economics, literature, etc. And it's something that has been part of my core identity throughout. When I went to Princeton, I literally studied everything and anything from the multivariable calculus to economic history to the Peloponnesian War and Russian literature. And that curiosity drives me to this day, which is why I have a tendency to, I read 50 to 100 books a year, and I know a lot about a lot of topics, at least enough to be dangerous.
50 to 100 books a year, that's very impressive considering all the different projects you're doing.
It's my bedtime routine. I read like 30 minutes to 1 hour almost every night, right before bed. And when I am in places where there's less distractions, so if I'm in Turks and Caicos or Bubblesoak, which is part of my life setup, there I read even more. Obviously in New York, given the insanity of the intellectual, social, professional life, it's harder to read too many books. But when I'm in Turks, I read like 2, 3, 4 books a week.
I saw that you haven't put a lot of new books on your recommended list on the website this year, but you did put Stealing Fire there with the importance of flow and how to achieve flow. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that before Ludwig goes on with the more work related questions?
It's my entire life I've come to appreciate flow states. So in fact, Stealing Fire articulates how you use flow states or can use flow states as a means of improving performance, which I think is a completely, I mean, it's not wrong, but it's not the reason I pursue flow states. I pursue flow states because they're enjoyable in their own right, and you feel amazing when you're in line with the universe and the universe's mission for you. And there are many ways to get there, whether it's mastery of a skill, whether it's meditation, whether it's through psychedelics or tantric sex or doing extreme activities. I'm about a head and walk to the the South Pole. I'm going to Antarctica in January, and I'm walking to the South Pole. I think these things are absolutely worth pursuing. And you're right, I haven't written book reviews in 2022, but I have many books to recommend. My favorite books of 2022 are A Hero of Two Worlds, which is the biography of Lafayette, who's an extraordinary gentleman who basically played a meaningful role both in the French and American Revolution. And the other book is called Warrior, King, Magician, Lover, which is a book on the modern masculine, if you want, from a tantric perspective. And it's really, really, really well written. But I also read a lot of sci-fi. My favorite book, frankly, of last year from a sci-fi perspective, I would still recommend. I suspect most readers or listeners of the podcast haven't read it yet. It's called Project Hail Mary. By far my favorite enjoyable book of the last 2 years from a reading perspective.
I did read Project Hail Mary. Or did you say the one? Because I think you mentioned two books on the website. One was the actual Project Hail Mary, and the other was some kind of a review of Hail Mary. I may have misread that. Like it was like something writing Project Hail Mary or something like that.
No, that anyway. Wasn't me. Hail Mary, absolutely amazing. And this year, as I said, Hero of Two Worlds and King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, rediscovering the archetypes of the mature masculine. I did read the Three Body Problem.
All three of them. Yeah.
There's a fourth book out, which I read as well. I would not recommend it for most people. I like the concepts that are defined in the Three Body Problem. It's one of the reasons I think you should be worried of whether or not aliens discover us or not. But for a normal, non-hardcore sci-fi fan, I find the fact that it's not written extremely well, it doesn't flow super well, that a lot of the concepts are abstract and complex, it doesn't make it the ideal recommendation for non-sci-fi readers. Project Hail Mary is a much easier read. It's very well written. It's super enjoyable. And people like my father, whom otherwise would not enjoy sci-fi, you know, completely loved it. So yes, I love Project Hail Mary, I love the Three Body Problem, but I also realize that it's a book written for people like me and not necessarily written for a general audience at large. And so it wouldn't be part of my general recommendation.
Okay. How do you select what type of new project you want to work on?
It's kind of like, how do I select the new activities I want to learn and the things I want to do? It's where my curiosity takes me. You know, so for instance, I wrote a lot this year about macroeconomics and economic policy. I have a background in economics and I studied it, I wrote it, I published in the topic. And there are periods in the world where macro trumps micro. And I was writing a lot about macroeconomics in 2005, 2006. I was fretting that we were getting into a real estate bubble that was going to lead a financial bubble. And of course, how it played out. And then I didn't write about it much in the entire decade of the 2010s. And as last year, as I felt that a bubble was inflating across all asset classes because of extraordinarily loose fiscal monetary policy, it started mattering to me again. I started writing about it because it started being on my mind. And the same thing, and it's the same approach I take for projects. When I find projects that I think are compelling or interesting, I follow my curiosity. And that's why in the last few years, I spent a lot of time in the crypto world because it garnered my curiosity. And I've been investing in and building in crypto projects in a way that we weren't doing before, frankly. And frankly, what I do professionally with FJ Labs is also a reflection of my curiosity, right? Like most VC firms invest in like 10, 20 companies a year, maybe 10, 20 companies per fund, right? And I invest in 200 to 300 companies a year. And to date, I'm an investor in 1,000 startups. It's also a reflection of my curiosity. There's so many problems in the world today, and there's so many fascinating people trying to solve these problems. And I want to back them. I want to be in a position to help them. And I want to be aware of the problems, and I want to be part of the solution for finding the problems. And you know, when people describe the problems of the 21st century, you have three big categories of problems. You have climate change, you have inequality of opportunity, you have the mental and physical well-being crisis. But these are just a category. Within climate change, you have carbon emissions, but within carbon emissions, you have the ones coming from manufacturing, which are different from the ones coming from agriculture, which are different from the ones coming from transportation. You have so many different subcomponents, which leads to so many different solutions for each of the subproblems. And so that was a long-winded way of saying I work in the things that interest me and that I find find interesting, that I find to be a combination, and those things are typically meaningful and difficult, and yet I find that there's something that I can do to move the needle there. And yeah, that was a pretty long-winded way to answer that question.
How or why do you think that your method works, that you don't run out of your or other people's money? Because it sounds like you let your intuition and your curiosity lead you. You kind of stoke your body machine with a lot of information, and you just trust that you will find good things. But investing in 1,000 startups, it would be pretty easy to go pretty wrong there.
So first of all, it sounds to people like I invest in everything I see because I invested in 1,000 startups. The reality is I'm extremely selective. Every week we get 200 to 300 startups that are being presented to us in Van. We're privileged that the deals are coming to us. Many of these deals are presented to us by our friends in the VC community and other founders, because we're not leading, we're not competing with them. We're really their friend, and we're value-added investors. And of the deals we see, we're invested in like 2 to 3% of them. It's a very, very low percentage overall. So we're highly selective. And at this point, one of the beauties of having invested in so many different companies is that we have great pattern recognition. I've met so many founders doing marketplace businesses that I have a very innate sense of whether or not something is going to work. And I also understand the marketplace dynamics, or do matching supply and demand effectively? Have you thought through what the correct pricing model is in light of the elasticity of supply and demand? What do your unit economics look like, et cetera? And so that pattern recognition, I think, leads to better decision making.
I completely agree with you that it's better to let all aspects of your brain and body make the decision, to sift through the like million times more information that can get to you that way than through your conscious mind. But it can still lead you very wrong. Do you have any big mistakes under your belt?
I have many, many mistakes under my belt. I think no one succeeds without having many mistakes under their belt. And in fact, that's the way you build resilience. And success is like lots of setbacks that you learn from and you pull yourself back from. People have the imagination that success is like a straight line, you know, top to the top and to the right, whereas it's like up and down and up and down. It's just more generally a little bit more up and down, which also leads to success. But I'll give you a few different types of mistakes. And in my very first company, I failed to convince my investors to sell to the right buyer, and so because someone else was offering a lot more money from a notional number perspective, and I'd also not negotiated a stockholder agreement where I could force the sale, and so we sold to someone, and the stock of that company fell 99.98% in the first bubble, and so I basically lost everything. I went from zero to hero back to zero again. On the investing side, I've done two different types of mistakes. Mistakes where I didn't invest in a company because, from a rational perspective, it didn't look like it would make sense. So for instance, I could have invested in Uber pretty early, but I looked at the burn and the unit economics. And I'm like, look, I'm going to regret this decision the rest of my life. But having seen the unit economics numbers and the burn, I can't do it. But I was so delighted by the experience. It should have occurred. If you start a sentence by "I'm going to regret this decision the rest of my life," you know you're making the wrong mistake. And I just wanted to be rational, which is why I didn't do the investment. And of course, I ended up investing in Uber, but much later at a higher price. I still made a fair amount of money, but not as much as I would have had I made that investment. And same thing, like I sold too early in some companies. I didn't invest in other companies. So you make a lot of mistakes. And I, even on the personal side, in 2012, I gave all my physical non-financial possessions to charity, and I went down to 50 items. And I decided, you know what? I want to reconnect with my friends. Let's go couch surfing and sleep on my friends' couches. And so the intent was like, you know, I was seeing that my relationship, my friendships were no longer as deep and meaningful as they were when I was in my 20s or in college, because the amount of time I was spending with my friends was lower because people get busy with life, with work, with kids, with relationships. And our meetings were biographical updates. I'm like, you know what? If I go couch surfing in their couches, it's going to be amazing. We're going to reconnect. It'll be the same way we were like 20 years ago. But it was a total failure. Embedding myself in their life when they weren't making room for it didn't work. Ultimately, after many iterations, I realized that actually, no, inviting them to come hang with me during school vacation, where there were activities organized for their kids and a place where they were separated from work and stress, were where we could reconnect was a much better solution. But I took many iterations to get there. Or likewise, I try to build a compound in the Dominican Republic where I try to bring founders and spiritual and artistic leaders together in order to just have a place to brainstorm and be present and create. And I thought the Dominican Republic made sense because it was close to the U.S. It was inexpensive. The northern part is very poor. I bought several hundreds of acres of land. I did not take into consideration the general geopolitical environment there, where the corruption, the crime, et cetera, basically made it non-viable. And after like 7 years and millions invested, I'm like, you know what? This is not working. It's time to move on. But one of the things I now take seriously is if I try something really, really hard and it doesn't work, it's a sign that it's not right for me and it's not meant to be happening. And I go and move on. So I left the Dominican Republic and I have a much smaller scale version of that project in Turks and Caicos, which is working really well. I was couch surfing and then staying in Airbnbs and hotels for like 4 years or 5 years, but eventually found a hybrid model that works for me where I own a place, which is a home where I can bring people together, but still own reasonably few assets because I value experiences more than assets. And so ultimately, all these mistakes lead to the ultimate outcome.
First of all, I just want to say, I think your idea with the Dominican Republic, it's a really cool idea. And then I want to go back to, you said that, had you invested in 1,000 companies with FJ Labs this year?
Oh, no. That's the total number of investments we've made historically to date. This year, I don't have the exact numbers, but it's probably going to be around 300 investments, including the follow-ons.
Right. So with regard to the macro situation, do you think 2023 will be the next time to start deploying more cash?
So first of all, I think the macro situation is going to be absolutely horrible in 23 and 24. In fact, way more horrible than people so people are pretty bearish right now, but I think the macro is going to be significantly more bearish. So I think the consensus is wrong, but it's wrong in not being bearish enough. And there's 9 factors that are overplaying each other that are each playing out. So first of all, you have interest rates that are going higher for longer than people expect. And this is one area where people have been wrong. The strong dollar is leading to a sovereign debt crisis in emerging markets. And you see places like, you know, Sri Lanka already defaulted, but like Ghana and Pakistan are under pressure. You have the high gas prices that are likely to cause a recession in Germany. You have a euro crisis looming with like super high debt to GDP ratios in places like Italy, and if anything happens there, it's going to be way worse than what happened with Greece a decade ago. You have a banking crisis on the horizon with people like Credit Suisse that are very weak. You have real estate prices that have been inflated by very low mortgage and interest rates for a long time. And now that we're seeing big increases in interest rates, you're going to have a big decrease in real estate prices pretty much around the world. You have a continued conflict in Ukraine and Russia, which are keeping grain, gas, and oil prices high. You have China, which used to be a force for economic growth and deflation, which is no longer that. And if anything, as people are like disentangling their supply chains as a source of inflation. And now we have like structurally higher geopolitical risk with like two kind of clans emerging. On the one side, you have like China, North Korea, Iran, Russia, and the other side, you have the West at large, plus, you know, Korea, Taiwan, et cetera. I mean, South Korea, obviously, Japan. Any one of these could lead to a recession, and all these things kind of playing out simultaneously. I suspect we're headed for a very bad recession. And that's why most VCs have been pulling back. Most people have been not investing. But I actually think in these environments, it's the best time to be investing in early stage startups. So in 2022, we were already contrarian. Most people pulled back and stopped investing. The reason we went full steam ahead and invested in early stage startups is I actually think, you know, so right now, first of all, the conditions for early stage startups as investors are amazing. Valuations are more reasonable. The founders are burn conscious. They're focused on unit economics. They're facing less competition. Customer acquisition costs are a lot lower. When they win, they're likely to win the entire category. And so even though the exit multiples would be lower, I suspect that we're going to do just as well. And if you look back in the 2010s, the best investments of the 2010s were made in 08, 09, 010, 011, or maybe all the way until 2013, 2014. And so that's like Uber, Airbnb, WhatsApp, Instagram, Slack, all those came out of the Great Recession of 07, 08. And the same way, I suspect the best investments of the 2020s will come out of the investments made in 22, 23, 24. So we are full steam ahead in investing in 23. That said, if I was a late stage investor, I would not be investing right now, right? Like, I think there'll be no IPOs. There's a massive overhang in crypto with Genesis and perhaps Binance and USDT, which means it's more likely to fall in the short term than go up, et cetera. So I'm very bearish macro and geopolitically, but I'm very bullish in terms of investing in early stage startups, because ultimately, on average, recessions last 11 months for the last, you know, since 1950. Even the longest one is like 2 years. And it ultimately, history trumps macro. And the technological revolution is going to continue to a pace, is going to attack categories and sectors that haven't been touched by it yet. So we're going to start seeing the deflationary power of technology express itself in B2B, in public services, in healthcare, in education, the sectors that haven't been touched by it yet. And we're going to see better user experiences and lower prices. And so I'm extraordinarily bullish on the future of tech and the future of the world because of tech.
That's really interesting. And first of all, do you think this specifically applies to angel investing, or do you also think it applies to listed stocks, public stocks?
So I think this applies specifically to early stage investing. And so even VC investing at like the seed, pre-seed, seed A, and maybe early Bs, it applies. Anything afterwards, it doesn't apply. So right now, there's still more downside risk, I think, in a lot of public stocks than there's upside risk, because interest rates can go up higher and longer than people expect because of the geopolitical situation as well, because of all the different overhangs in the economy. And I think we're not in a recession yet. We haven't had negative growth, and inflation is remaining reasonably high. So I would not, right now, if I look at my personal wealth allocation, I'm 20% cash, 70% early stage tech startups, and 10% real estate, which is really consumption. I don't actually consider it to be an investment, and nothing else. No bonds, no public stocks, literally nothing else. I think everything else is poised to fall. Now, of course, I'm in a very good position that I've been a very successful early stage investor, and I have deal flow, and I know how to get returns from it, which I realize that portfolio is not easy for other people to replicate, that barbell approach. But no, I would not be investing in public stocks right now, unless you happen to be extremely bullish in certain categories, right? Like I'm very bullish in the long run in food delivery. And in food delivery, I'm very bullish on a company called Delivery Hero, which is a leader in Southeast Asia. And I would be happy to invest now and go on and I think there's a 10x from where we're at. But I'm not a public market investor. And I think right now there are more better opportunities in the private side.
Among the really early stage companies, are there any particular sectors that you're more interested in, that you're actively looking for investments for 2023, like, I don't know, AI or biotech or nanotech, or well, feel free to elaborate.
Yeah, so my specialty is marketplace businesses, and especially and network effect businesses, because they are capital efficient, winner takes most, and when you win, you win really, really big. And I don't love hardware businesses or biotech, et cetera. A, it's not my expertise, but B, typically they require a lot more capital to get a proof of point. It takes a lot longer to get a scale. And things like AI, all the companies I invest in use AI, but I don't invest in the AI technology itself. I invest in applied technology. So we're investors in a company called Rebag, which is a marketplace for high-end handbags. So they use AI to identify which handbag you're trying to sell and give you a price for it. And that's an amazing user experience, but it's not an AI company. It uses AI. And so we do applied technology, which I think is way more compelling and interesting than just pure underlying research, which has a tendency to be commoditized. A lot of, the biggest exit in the AI world right now has been the DeepMind, which was bought by IBM, Google for $400 million. And the issue is a lot of these AI are given away through APIs or for free, right? Like, so Microsoft, Google, et cetera, make it available, doesn't give you an opportunity to, and having the data sets is so relevant. So I think ChatGPT is fascinating, but we're probably at the beginning of the hype cycle here. The real applications will be 30 years away. So I think there'll be the trough of disillusionment before you get to the actual successful applications that people that people focus on. But to answer your question there, I told you what I'm not doing. I did tell you what I am focused on in 2023. It's basically B2B marketplaces that I find the most compelling. We're digitizing the world. In the consumer world, you already have extraordinary experiences. You know, think of Booking.com and Airbnb and Amazon and Uber, where you have these magical experiences where everything's delivered to you very quickly and you can track everything. In the B2B world, you have no price discovery. You have no effective payment mechanisms. You have no tracking on your delivery. You have no integration in your ERP systems. And so taking every single category and industry and vertical and digitizing it, I think is a huge opportunity. I mean, think of petrochemicals as like a $1 trillion category or industry, or steel, or the labor forces that work for these. We're talking hundreds of billions of industries that are still where everything is done either offline or through Excel or email, there's so many efficiencies to be gained from that. So I'm extremely bullish on digitizing the B2B world.
So you mentioned chemicals and commodities, and I looked at your blog and you mentioned, I think, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but for chemicals, you had the nod.com.
Correct.
And then for commodities, you had rebus.com.
Yeah, Rebus is a steel marketplace. And these are two examples, but like we're investors in the B2B side. I mean, in B2B marketplaces to supply SMBs, you know, like Slice for pizzerias or Deco for coffee. We're investors in labor marketplaces for nurses, like Trusted Health. I mean, all of these are ginormous categories. And, but yeah, I interrupted you, but yeah, very bullish on Node or Node and Rebus.
Yeah, I looked at them and also what you had written, and it seemed like incredibly good companies with very, very strong growth potential. Do you think they will be listed publicly later in a few years?
I could see that. I mean, they're both large and growing very quickly, but there's many more than that. I mean, like I think the companies in the portfolio in the B2B world that are more likely to list in a few years when the macro turns, Flexport, which is a tech-enabled freight forwarder, which is huge and doing really well, or ShipBob, which is a last-mile delivery company, also doing, you know, hundreds of millions of revenues and completely crushing it. These two probably are higher on the list. They're already worth billions, completely aligned with the current problems of history and industry. And industry. So they're probably further down the pipe of going public than Node and Rebus, but those two are doing really well as well. So Rebus is probably next. Node, I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but probably a few years away.
I can totally see how this is a great industry, and based on what you've written on your blog and so forth, it's really, really impressive. But I want to go back a little bit to the macro situation, where obviously you listed these nine things that are really bad in the coming years. But if we take something like higher energy prices over the coming years, obviously that's going to be quite an inflationary force and bad for the overall global economy. But then if you kind of counteract that with a positive growth and deflationary force of technology over the next coming years, how do you see that playing out? Do you think that kind of the big mega trend of digitization and improving efficiency, for example, through these different companies that you're investing in, do you think that can kind of on the global scale outweigh the higher energy prices, for example?
In the long run, absolutely, right? So in the short term, because of the geopolitical situation, we're seeing higher oil prices. But if anything, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste, right? The Churchill quotes. It's accelerating the energy transition in many countries, and most countries are now focusing on accelerating their energy transition, starting with Germany. And the solar, and I'm extremely bullish on solar, is continuing to be amazingly deflationary. So solar has been declining in cost on average by 11% a year for the last 40 years. So cost divided by 10 in the last decade, by 10 again the decade before. So we're 100x decrease in price in the last 20 years. And this is a trend that's continuing. So energy production through solar is already cheaper than it is through any other form of production. So it's cheaper than nuclear, than coal, than gas, than oil, you name it. The issue has been storage, because of course it's intermittent and only works during the day, and battery prices were too high. But even when you add storage is also improving dramatically. Lithium-ion battery prices divided by 10 also in the last decade. And this trend is continuing. And at the current rate, there is a point in time in the coming decade where solar plus storage will be cheaper than all other forms of energy production. And it's highly deflationary. I mean, I suspect we're 20 years away from being having energy that's too cheap to meter. And so I actually think, if anything, the short-term inflationary oil prices and gas prices that are high are accelerating the transition, which will lead us to renewables and especially solar. And there's also perhaps lucky, I don't know if lucky is the right word, but like exogenous events that could happen. Like maybe everyone heard about the ignition in the fusion reactor that created more energy than was put in. So it isn't quite correct in the way in the way they calculated it, in the sense that they didn't include the energy required to run the machine. But if we get a fusion breakthrough with commercial fusion, though, I think if we're still 10, 20 years away, that also changes the game dramatically. But extraordinarily bullish on solar and its ability to decrease energy prices. I really think we are going to have an energy transition away from greenhouse gas emissions, and we will have energy too cheap to meter in the next 20, 30 years. And so extraordinarily bullish and optimistic on our ability to deal with the climate crisis.
Right. So obviously we all know that since the COVID crisis happened, different kind of technology companies and internet-based companies got a huge boost from that in adoption worldwide. What kind of sectors do you think are going to be extra interesting just because of that improved adoption?
I'll answer in a counterintuitive way. So for instance, what got the biggest boost during COVID was food delivery, right? So food delivery, and frankly, e-commerce in general, where both, everything was being ordered online. You saw a massive explosion in quick commerce as well, where you had like the 10-minute deliveries, the Gorillas and Getir, or 15-minute deliveries that became relevant. But as COVID ended, and even though you had a step change in penetration decreased, all of them started shrinking. And also there was way too much competition. So there was a boom in COVID, followed by a bust post-COVID. So right now, for instance, food delivery is actually in the doldrums. It's completely, if you look at public markets, food delivery stock prices are down like 90%. The reality is also true of fintech, of property tech, of automotive tech, like the companies like Carvana. Everything's down like 90%. But that said, over the long run, I actually continue to be extraordinarily bullish. It doesn't make sense to me that the amount of time people spend like going to the supermarket, selecting food, preparing food, cooking food, etc. When you include the opportunity cost of time, it's extraordinarily expensive. The problem with food delivery today, for instance, is that it's low quality food. You know, it's like cheap Thai food and pizzas and burgers, etc. It's expensive because you include delivery costs. But imagine a world where 10 years in the future, all the food is made in dark kitchens and highly automated, such that the meal is prepped in like 3 minutes, where the delivery is done, whether by drone, if it's not in urban areas, or automated or autonomous vehicles in urban areas, and the marginal cost of delivery is low and the delivery is quick. I can imagine a world where over 50% of all the food is actually ordered online and an app, and you're going to have high quality, nutritious food that is going to be organic and healthy and a good price point, frankly, cheaper than you can make it yourself, not even including the opportunity cost of your time. And that's why I'm so bullish on the category, even though right now it's completely in the doldrums, right? But if you look at public markets or private markets, so VCs will not touch food delivery or food stuff with a 100-foot pole. I actually think right now is actually the best time to start thinking about what comes next and how do you build the world that I just described.
And in the world that you describe, where energy is too cheap to meter and you get all your food, I don't know, grown in vertical labs and delivered more or less for free since energy is free, how do you lead an epic life, as you talked about when reviewing the book Green Lights, how do you lead an epic life from here on? You've already led an epic life, but well, the next 50 years.
So first of all, more people are leading epic lives today than they were leading in the past, because in the past we were on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, basically fighting for survival. People don't realize, like, if I take you back 200 years to 1822, global life expectancy was 29. Life expectancy was below 40 in every single country in the world. 90%+ of the population was farmers living on less than a dollar a day. And you would go hungry multiple times a year. And you were working 70, 80 hours a week in order to just survive. And now in the West, more and more people, we work less than 40 hours a week. We have vacations. And we have a quality of life unimaginable by the kings of yesteryear. We're extremely privileged. And because we have that extra time, not all of us, but some of us are in a position to actually pursue our interests that are non-professional. And if I go to this future I describe, and this is really the future I want to build. I want to build a world where we're ecologically sustainable. We have equality of opportunity, where everyone has their basic needs met. Where I'll take you if you were world 100 years in the future. 100 years in the future, where basically you have a atomic level printer where you can just go to it and say, I need food or water or whatever, a computer, and most of your needs are met for free. And by the way, in that world, it's not the end of capitalism, because even though a lot of these things are given away for free or made for free, there's still some scarce resources, right? And by the way, it's capitalism that's going to get us there, because you need the incentive mechanism for people to go and build all this stuff. In this world, you still have like real estate that's going to be scarce resource, and people are sort of valuing other things. They'll want to be spaceship captains. They'll want to be singers and artists. Leading an epic life in that future world will be easier for more people, because their fundamental needs will be met. You'll have more free time. And with that extra free time, you're going to be able to pursue your passions, whatever those may be. And we're going to have more writers, more artists, more athletes, and people doing things just because they want to, right? Like in the world of Star Trek, The Next Generation, people pursue things like being starship captains, not because they need to get paid for it, but because it's something that they find is interesting and meaningful, and exploring the universe is a worthy endeavor. And hopefully we get a position where we're in a position to do that. So I want more and more people. I want to build a world that is ecologically sustainable, where more and more people can actually pursue epic lives.
Apart from the Star Trek reference, are there any other pop cultural references that you can make that you think more describes your kind of future? I'm thinking of either Eric Drexler with the coming era of nanotechnology, or Ray Kurzweil perhaps with his The Singularity Is Near, or maybe Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson. I think these might resonate.
I've read all of these. I'm not sure the singularity is that near. I suspect there's a level
nearer
of
now. I hear it's nearer now. He's releasing an update.
It's nearer. Yes, that's definitionally true. Every day that comes, I don't know. TBD when we get AGI ASI. I'm not sure anytime soon. Look, do I think something like ChatGPT could pass the Turing test very soon? Yes, probably. Might even do so already. I haven't looked. It doesn't mean you get AGI. It definitely doesn't mean you get ASI. No, the world I mean, I have a very clear vision of what it looks like. The
actual question was, do you have any particular book?
Yeah,
or
I'm trying to think that... through, you know, works of fiction that are great representations of it. The problem is most fiction focuses on something went horribly wrong. You know, like most fiction is like, in order to create drama, there's like, and they blew themselves on the way to try to build their utopia, or the machines took over and we're in a Terminator type scenario, or the aliens are invading, or and it's very rarely that you end up in a wonderful utopia where you're living where you're living in harmony with nature, and pursuing the things that bring you meaning. And I do think different individuals are built very differently, and the things that bring the meaning is pretty fundamentally different. So it's not necessarily portrayed anywhere because that doesn't create the tension and the drama. And by the way, the path there is hard. And even in that world, there will be tension, right? Like to the extent we have borders and countries and cultural differences and different belief systems, so there will always be tension. So even that world, it's not as though we're never, you know, it's like problems just change over time. If you go back to whatever, the 13th century would be all about like religious wars between Protestants and or the Catholics or whatever. We'd be in the 100-year war between England and France. Then we'd have religious wars between Protestants and Catholics. Then we'd like, so whatever the defining, or maybe yeah, the Crusades, you know, so whatever the defining issues of our time are, just evolve. So even if we address all the issues we're currently seeing, which are climate change and equality of opportunity and the mental and physical well-being crisis, will there be more challenges to overcome? Absolutely. And which may very well include actually interacting with aliens or whatever, to the extent we ever get faster than light travel, which is far from clear. And if we never get there, because you can't, not that I think we can necessarily go faster than the speed of light, but like maybe you can create wormholes or like shortcuts in space. And if you can't, yeah, maybe it'll be a lonelier place in space, and maybe we'll have fewer of these routes.
Do you follow some of the larger marketplace stocks, for example, Shopify, Spotify, Etsy, Match, Booking?
I do not actually. I don't follow public public stocks, they don't really impact me. I guess they could be potential buyers for the companies I invest in, but no, I don't really follow public markets. I don't follow news either, by the way. Like I think news is negative and sensationalist entertainment that's like repetitive and it's a massive waste of your time, and it primes your brain to be full of like negative information. I'm extremely well informed because I read books and research papers on topics and where I meet experts, but I do not follow day-to-day news. I think it's and like kind of following stocks, I feel falls in that category. Like entertainment.
Mm, all right. I mean, you founded first Auckland, like an auction marketplace, and then also OLX, a classifieds marketplace. So I'm wondering, if you were starting fresh, maybe age 25 or younger, what kind of marketplace do you think you would start today?
So I said earlier that the marketplaces that I'm focusing on right now are vertical B2B marketplaces, but actually they're hard for a 25-year-old to build because the people that are building them usually come from the industry. They come there, they understand the problems, and they have the credibility to convince people from the industry to change, right? So the founder of Rebus bought $1 billion worth of Seal before trying to go and build Rebus. The founder of Noti came from the industry. 25-year-old today, look, I think follow your curiosity and your passion. If you're into crypto, go do crypto. If you're an AI expert, go build AI stuff. If you're really worried of the climate crisis, go and climate companies. Follow your curiosity, follow your passion. There's infinite opportunities, but look at where the problems are and how it intersects with your skill set and your interests, and go after that. But marketplaces, there's so many that are being built today. I mean, we're building a lot of crypto-enabled marketplaces that are using crypto dynamics as an alternative for customer acquisition costs right now. These are really interesting. And we're continuing to verticalize marketplaces. So yeah, we're at very early stages. And by the way, I don't think marketplaces are the end-all be-all. People do need to be building the fundamental building blocks of tech that we use in the marketplaces we build. And so if you're into biotech, do biotech, right? Like my personal curiosity takes me into looking at longevity. I do look at the physics of fusion for fun. Now, I don't invest in it. I'm a gamer. I love gaming. I don't invest in games and video games, but I love playing them. So I think it's follow your interests and look at how it intersects with the size of the problems and your skill sets.
I think the question about young people, it tends to lean toward how do I get rich and successful, but it seems as if your curiosity and your very diverse sets of what actually drives you, what you think has intrinsic value, it doesn't really take money. I mean, computer games are more or less free, and you can,
yes,
perhaps kite surfing perhaps isn't free, but you can at least swim in the ocean.
It's cheap. No, kite surfing is cheap. No, you know what? It's interesting. Like, I never pursued money. I became wealthy as a byproduct of what I did and what I did well. The world happens to value a skill set that I have of building and investing in tech startups, and therefore, as a result, I'm financially rewarded for it. And it has afforded me an amazing life and freedom that's extraordinary. But it was never the objective. And by the way, I've been bankrupt multiple times, right? Along the way. I mentioned the Hero to Zero, the first startup where I almost made hundreds of millions of dollars, but instead went bankrupt. And the second startup, I had to live in New York on the couch of the office at $2 a day for 2 years. I missed payroll 27 times. You know, and I worked 100 hours a week. Life is about trade-offs as well. Like, I was working 100 hours a week from probably age at the latest 15, possibly earlier onwards. You know, I didn't have friends. I didn't have a girlfriend until I was 27. I had a sense of manifest destiny, a mission, and I was pursuing my mission, but I was actually pretty, really happy. Like, I didn't feel I was losing anything. I was pursuing my mission, and I became wealthy as a consequence or as a byproduct of what I was doing on a daily basis. But if you're doing it for the money, I think it ultimately fails, because if there's a point in time, imagine there are two people competing, and one of them is doing it because for the money, and they're working 100 hours a week, burning themselves out. You know, they have their wife and kids at home yelling at them for not being there. And the other guy is doing it because they love what they're doing. The person who's loving what they're doing, they're going to win every time. And so do the things you love. And obviously try to find ways that things that are monetizable, right? So I would not recommend you go and major in art history, even though you may love art history, because I think it makes it harder for you to earn funds. So think through what your interests are and how you can actually find ways to monetize it. That said, what I love about the world of the 20 21st century is there are more and more ways to monetize your passion. You only need 1,000 fans, you know, to love what you do. So if you're a writer, you can build a following on Substack. If you're an artist, you can go to Patreon. If you like playing video games, you could go to Twitch. And again, it's not everyone can succeed in doing these things, but there are more and more paths for making money than ever before in things that are aligned with your passion. You no longer need to do repetitive things. And that's why I really like this new world where people were worried, automation destroys jobs. Yeah, it destroys scrappy jobs. And instead, it creates jobs that are way more interesting. It frees up time of humanity to do things that you're great at. Like, I cannot wait for doctors to no longer be diagnostic machines, that it's an AI that does it. And instead, we're going to have doctors who are going to be compassionate and nice with great bedside manners. They're going to be helping you make sure that you have compliance. And it'll be a completely different skill set than the doctors we have today. But, you know, let the AI do the stuff that it's good at. Let's have humans do the things that humans are good at. Humans should not be flipping burgers and like, you know, putting a widget into a device like a billion times over. Robots can do that. Humans should be using curiosity, passion, and compassion, empathy.
Yeah, definitely. By the way, can you describe your current day-to-day balance between things like B2B digitization and extreme sports and searching for flow states? Because these can seem pretty different things to do. And how much time do you spend indoors versus outdoors, for example?
So I've iterated a lot on this. And it doesn't work. So my definition or description of it would not be day-to-day, but actually more month by month. So I find that there are places that are, I need balance in life, absolutely, but that I don't need that balance every day. And there are periods where there are places where it's better to be in those places. So I try to spend September, October, April, May, June in New York. New York is a haven of professional, intellectual, social, artistic simulation beyond my wildest dreams. I host intellectual salons. I bring together extremely interesting people to talk about like everything and anything in the future of humanity. I host professional breakfast, lunch, and dinners. I go out at like every show you can imagine. It is a life that is extraordinarily rich on the professional and intellectual side. It is not a life that is rich of kitesurfing and extreme adventures, etc. But that's okay. I don't go to New York for that. But after a month or two in New York, I feel that I need balance. And I get that balance in other locations. So then I go to Turks and Caicos in November and December. I go to Turks and Caicos in March and part of April and part of February. And there I do Zoom calls during the day, you know, B2B marketplaces, etc. Internal calls, external calls, talking to VCs. But then all of these things were available in New York. These professional, intellectual, social, artistic salons are not there. So there I will be meditating. I'll be reading. I'll be writing. I'll be doing kitesurfing. I'll be playing tennis or paddle 2 hours a day. Like I was just in Turks for 2 months. And I exercise at least 2 hours a day every day. In addition to lifting weights 3 times a week. But I was like, I finished these periods. I'm in the best shape of my life. But I've done that for 2 months. And now now I'm going to walk to the South Pole, so it's different. But now it's time for something different. In the winter, I go heli skiing in Revelstoke in January and February, which I absolutely love. I typically try to add a new exotic trip every year. This year, of course, I'm walking to the South Pole, but I've crossed Costa Rica and bicycled from the Atlantic to the Pacific. I've done survival training in the jungles of Guyana. I've walked with the Maasai warriors during the animal migration in Tanzania. So I do one of these every year. And then in July, I go see my family in the south of France. And then in August, I go hiking, camping, etc. in Revelstoke in British Columbia in the middle of Canada. And then I go to Burning Man every year. And so each place has a different role. Now, for most of these, I'm actually working most days. So I have Zoom calls, meetings, etc. all day long and emails and get several hundred emails a day. But I can balance it. It's just, what do I balance it with? In New York, I balance it with social, professional, intellectual, artistic endeavors. In Turks, it's kiting and ski and paddle and swimming and e-foiling and tennis and reading and meditating, etc. And Revelstoke in the winter, it's skiing. And Revelstoke in the summer, it's mountain biking and hiking instead of paddle boarding. In France, it's with family time and also a lot of tennis and paddle and eating delicious food. And of course, Burning Man is actually full on disconnection. And I try to disconnect fully for a week or two, a few times a year. So when I'm heli-skiing, pretty disconnected. Burning Man, I'm completely disconnected. And the trips I do in the middle of like the rainforest or Antarctica or whatever, fully disconnected. Like no calls, no emails, no WhatsApp, no nothing. Where I could be alone with my thoughts, doing something challenging and pursuing these flow states that we discussed.
It's a great review of your balance. Okay, I have three hopefully pretty quick questions. One is, do you drink alcohol? Doesn't seem to be any place for alcohol in that. That
I do not drink alcohol.
And
it's a poison. Let me expand upon that. Alcohol is a poison. When you drink alcohol, your liver goes in overdrive to deal with it, which means that all food process basically instantaneously turns into fat. It decreases your sleep quality. It makes you sleepy, but it actually decreases the amount of deep and REM sleep you get. It is a bad drug. I do partake in psychedelics. I will take magic mushrooms or acid occasionally, and I will occasionally also do very deep journeys of on these substances or ayahuasca, but occasionally, like once every 2 years or once a year, at most once a year. But no, alcohol is a very bad drug. Do not try to not consume it, even socially. And there's no stigma these days for not taking it socially. Yeah, I have herbal tea.
Very good. And second, what's the worst injury you've had during? You do a lot of extreme sporting. Take a couple.
I'll give you a lot. I've dislocated my right shoulder 13 times, and everything from heli skiing, tennis, to rollerblading, etc. I dislocated my right hip playing tennis. I've had third-degree burns on my leg from the engine of a motorcycle falling on my leg. I used a motorcycle. Didn't happen motorcycle racing, but I used a motorcycle race as well. I broke my hand. I broke my foot. I've almost died a few times. I fell off a cliff at first. I've been in avalanches. Yeah, I know. But most of these were nothing happened. So, but no, the dislocations and of the shoulder and the hip and the third degree burns from the motorcycle engine on my leg, it's probably the worst.
And the third one here is, what's your role at Burning Man? Who are you? I haven't been there. I've read about a bit on it. And I mean, I think you're not supposed to have any currency at all, but you can have things to trade with. Who are you? What do you do? Do you do different things every time?
So it depends. Like this last Burning Man, I was actually showing my brother what it was like and spending time with him. And he doesn't take supplements or psychedelics. So it was a completely sober one. When I go alone, which is my preference to go alone, I like to, so it depends. But what I love to do is basically drop acid and bike around. Bike around through time and space, look at all the art and be present in that moment. Like it's beyond, it's so magical and beautiful. And every year when I do it, I don't do it every night, I just do it one night and usually early in the week. I get a sense that we are all one. We have a sense of oneness. It's extraordinary. And that we're all here to entertain each other. And so our gifts to each other is whatever we're amazing at. And so your gift to the world is whatever you can teach, share, and bring to others, either as knowledge and expertise or as entertainment. We are here both to entertain and help teach each other. And it comes always within massive overlay of be kind, be good, be compassionate. Share your gifts to the world in a conscious, enlightened, kind, empathetic way.
I was a bit surprised to not see any books on related topics on your website, and neither on quantum mechanics, especially the foundational quantum mechanics like David Bohm, for example, or Sean Carroll. How come? Because it seems like this is actually a pretty big part of your inner life.
Yeah, so I've written a lot. I've read a lot of books on spirituality. Most of them are not particularly well written, the thing is, my spiritual practice comes from having worked with many different teachers and reading hundreds of books, most of which and none of them is like a great summary of what I, you know. So I this summer while at Burning Man, I read 7 books on spirituality. I read Not in His Image, which is a kind of a book of the pagan and agnostic religions prior to Christianity. society. I've read The Immortality Key, which is on the psychedelic origins of Christianity. Would I recommend any of these specifically? Not sure. Perhaps I think some books on the masculine and the feminine, so The Way of the Superior Man by David Data, or on the feminine, or maybe a book on modern tantraism like Urban Tantra. They're worth reading, but the problem is they only touch elements of the way I think about this. And so I haven't found like the definitive book that I'm like, you must read this and it will give you an amazing perspective on how to lead your life, etc. If I was to write a book one day, I think it would be called Life, and it would be on how to lead a life and that is balance and how you can really design the life you want, and would include a spiritual component, including, because look, I do have a very reasonably advanced spiritual practice and meditation practice, but it's specific to me and I've built it over time. And there's no book that we're like, oh, read this, and it'll give you all the insights that I've gleaned. So, but you're right. I do read a lot of on physics and math and spirituality, and I haven't recommended many books in the category. I'm not sure there have been that many to recommend. I think that's part of the issue, like that lay people would appreciate.
One very important part of having a good life is making good decisions. And you're very good at making decisions, and you've also outlined a process on your blog. Could you maybe summarize this process or explain how you go about making important decisions?
Yeah, I try to be extremely deliberate in the very important decisions I do in my life. So every few years, but whenever you're facing a fundamental choice in your life, what I do is I write myself a letter, an email, and I lay out what am I happy with the life that I'm leading today? What am I unhappy with? What could I change from that? And what are all the options? In what ways could my life be different? And that could be a different job. And in worst case, I would list all the other jobs I could have. It could be a different relationship, you know, like should you get married or break up or have kids? And I write that without trying to reach a conclusion. I just lay out freeform all the options available. And I try to imagine myself in not the ideal day, but a typical day in that new position. What would the day look like? What I would like, what I would not like. I then share that email with my, so that's step one. Think through how happy or unhappy you are with where you are, and what are all the different options, which could include fixing the issue that you're dealing with, if there are any. And I try to do this whenever I'm facing fundamental decisions. Like the example I give in my blog, I mean, I give a lot of examples. One of the examples is I was running OLX, king of the world, and yet I was not very happy because my job was no longer playing with product. It was like dealing with being part of a massive publicly traded company. And so I laid out all the options. Should I stay? If that's what, should I change? And I laid out 9 other things I could do instead of that. Then share that email. And by the way, I laid out like options that were like, I try to convince the Castros to let me run part of Cuba. You know, I put like things that are way out there. No limits on skill or anything. Don't people tell themselves stories of things they can't do. You can do anything. So don't limit yourself. Put everything out there. I wrote like, be a public intellectual, buy Craigslist, whatever. So number two, share that email with close friends and advisors, and tell them to read this and give you their opinion in 2 different ways. One way is if it was them, what would they do? And 2, them knowing you, because of course you are not them, knowing you, what would they do if they were you? And because usually you get a very different answer based on the 2 questions, and you have a bunch of interactions. Then step number 3, try a lot of these things, because life is iterative, and usually you can actually throw, and think of the way the entrepreneurs work. Founders throw spaghetti in the wall and they see what sticks. And we test everything with the business model, even like the color of the site or the button, does it sell or list for free or sell for free? We A/B test everything. People don't do enough of that in their life. They should try more things to see what's right for them, which leads me to point number 4, or step number 4, assess what worked, what didn't work, and then iterate. I earlier in this conversation, I said how I try to go couch surfing on my friends' couches as a means of reconnecting with my friends, and that failed. But it led me to say I did want to reconnect with my friends. And so I kept iterating our models to find a way to have a better, deeper connection with my friend and family. And now I bring my friends and family every year for Christmas in Turks and Caicos. I just had a family and friends and family gathering. So the family you choose and the family you have. And there was 30 of us and we had a blast. And I do this every year and it's part of a new tradition. But I didn't start with there. I iterated to finding myself as this being the conclusion until I got to the life I wanted to lead.
What would be some of your advice to someone who wants to invest in private companies? companies?
If there are different ways to get into angel investing, right? If your friends are of age that they're building companies, invest in their companies. If you're already in tech, you typically already see deal flow. One of the ways to do it is just invest in, invest in a fund, especially an angel list, see what they see, the deals they look at, how they work, etc., and then use that as a platform for going and doing direct deals. There are many ways in. I mean, most of the people that I find that are angel that get into angel investing typically are tech in the tech community themselves, and therefore their friends are building companies and they start investing in their friends' companies. So it's probably the most common way, right? Like, it's very rare that someone who's not into tech all of a sudden decides that, oh, I'm going to be a tech investor.
If we take, for example, well, you're extremely specialized in marketplaces, but do you know of anyone who is doing very well as an angel investor, but investing across a broad spectrum of different kind of categories?
There are different types of specialization, right? I specialize in marketplace business models, but I invest in every category and industry, in every geography, in every stage. So I'm actually very diversified in terms of stage, geography, and industry. And like, I will do things in the space world if it's a marketplace. I will do things in the climate world if it's a marketplace, so like carbon offset marketplaces or grid management software and things like that. I know a lot of people that take other levels of specialization. They don't specialize in a business model. So our specialization is the business model. We do not specialize in geography, stage, or category. I know other people instead, they say, no, I'm going to specialize in a stage. I'm only going to do Series A or they specialize in B2B SaaS, or they specialize in a sort of geography. I'm from Colombia. I know Colombia really. I'm going to do Colombia. So you can pick your specialization. You probably want an edge. You don't want to do, you can't be an expert in everything. And again, that edge should be related to your expertise and your background. But I do know many people who invest in, and that's true of many VCs, who invest in like many different types of industries, for sure.
My final question is really a last question. So I'm not sure if Ludwig has anything more, but that would be, is there any way for you to summarize what your final and ultimate driver is, the absolute thing that your life is about, what everything else is maintenance for?
Oh, absolutely. I want to make the world a better place. And I have a vision of how to accomplish that by using technology. My personal mission is harnessing the power of technology, both its power to improve user experiences and to be deflationary, to address the world's problems. And the three world's problems that I'm seeing are climate change, inequality of opportunity, and the mental and well-being crisis. And so I want to bring about this world that I described earlier, where we are at a place where it's environmentally sustainable, it's conscious, where people have an amazing quality of life and can pursue their dreams. And that's my life's mission, and I'm using technology as a means of achieving it. And everything else is a path. It helps me accomplish that mission, including, by the way, things like kite surfing and playing video games, etc. Like, it's what gives me the balance to have the energy to go and pursue that mission.
All right. So but once we're there, once we have that world, I guess you would, let's say there actually is an end point. You can comment whether you think there is an end point or not, whether we can actually get to that place. But once we're there, I guess you would still be kite surfing, meeting with people, looking for new insights and perspectives and things like that. That's what kind of an even more ultimate driver rather than mission that I'm looking for, or your intrinsic driver.
I mean, look, my curiosity will continue of like trying to understand and unravel the mysteries of reality and how to lead an amazing life. And by the way, even if we get to this world, I suspect there will be more problems to come, right? So I described, like, there are always problems, and I will try to find a way and use my skill set to try to address them, to leave the world in a better place than I found it.
Okay, so we want to be respectful of your time, because you do have a doctor's appointment coming up, correct?
I do.
Yeah, so thank you very much for being on the podcast. You're a very interesting guy, and I hope our listeners will enjoy it as well.
Is there anything you want to tell our listeners about where to find you or read up on you? I mean, I find your blog extremely interesting and diverse, and super cool book recommendations, and your life, the life you've led, everything is like super inspiring.
Yeah, the easiest is my blog, FabriceGrinda.com. And if you want to reach out to me, especially with a startup you want me to evaluate, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn and make sure you include enough information to be able to assess whether it's for me or not. Like, so include the deck and a blurb, et cetera.
Hey, super cool. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.